My humble pranams at the lotus feet of the Bhagwan. Sairam, everybody. We've been blessed today, you know, and we should thank Swami for giving us an opportunity to have satsang with our brother Lad. And he has come all the way from California yesterday to share his experiences with us. Lad has been a part of the Sai family for the last 21 years. And I'm sure he has a lot to share with us today. During his last 21 years in the Sai fold, one of the highlights has been he has orchestrated Christmas choir. And let me assure you one thing. Of what I've spent the last evening with him and today, he's going to keep you engrossed for the next few hours. So with that said, you know, I would welcome Brother Lad to join us, to share yours.
Sairam, brothers and sisters, by some miracle, Southwest Airlines took me here from California yesterday. For whatever reason, we have important time to share with each other. And before we get started, I would like to teach you all a song. So, Sam, I expect some percussion help on this. What I'm going to talk to you about today is surrender. And I have several PhDs in this department. So this song, this is in G if you want to play along. And it's a round, it's in two parts. So I'm going to teach you the first part and the second part. We'll just try it. It goes like this. I didn't write this song, but I learned it recently and I love it. Here's how it goes. Into your hands I lay my spirit. Try that with me. Into your hands I lay my spirit. The second part goes like this. Into your hands I lay my life. Into your hands I lay my life. Now we're going to put it together. It goes like this. Into your hands I lay my spirit. You sing with me. Into your hands I lay my life. My life. We'll try that again. Into your hands I lay my spirit. Into your hands I lay my life. That's the first part. Here's the B section. Into your hands I, into your hands I, into your hands I lay. Into your hands I lay my life. Try that with me. Into your hands I, into your hands I, into your hands I lay. It goes up here. Into your hands I lay my life. Now we'll go back to the beginning. Into your hands I lay my spirit. Into your hands I lay my life. Into your hands I lay my spirit. Into your hands I lay my life. Now we'll go to the B section here. Into your hands I, into your hands I, into your hands I lay. And it goes up. Into your hands I lay my life. Into your hands I, into your hands I, into your hands I lay. Into your hands I lay my life. And now we're going to try to put it together. We're now going to try it as a round. You ready? Okay, the men, I'm going to start you, and the ladies are going to come in. Into your hands I lay my spirit. Into your hands I lay my life. Into your hands I lay my spirit. Into your hands I lay my life. All right, ladies, you start that. Into your hands I, into your hands I, into your hands I lay. Into your hands I lay my life. All right, ladies, you just do that part. Into your hands I, into your hands I, into your hands I lay. Into your hands I lay my life. You just stay on that. I'm going to get the men to do this. Into your hands I lay my spirit. You stay on your part. Into your hands I lay my life. Into your hands I, into your hands I, into your hands I lay. Into your hands I lay my life. My life. My life. We're going to have to practice that because tomorrow we're going to teach a larger group. We don't have a train wreck tomorrow at Chicago Metro. Is some of you coming tomorrow or no? This will be the last time we're together. Some of us will be there. Okay. All right. It feels like we're so spread out, almost like, you know, you could come a little bit closer here. First of all, I just want to thank Swami for arranging this. Allowing me to come here and speak to you. I have had a beautiful evening at Krishna and Chandrika and Shriya's house, and I even got to tickle Shriya this morning when she woke up. What I'd like to share with you today is a little bit of my journey, how I came to Swami, how I came to be standing here in front of you today. Some of the things that I've been through, as I was telling Krishna and Chandrika, I have experienced many blessings. I have also experienced many blastings. And if you look closely, you can probably see tire tracks all across this back here, where the avatar has run over me backwards and forwards, and he has put me on the barbecue, and he has just roasted me till I was a crispy critter. So what you're seeing here is these little gray hairs. I earned every one of them on my last 21-year journey with Swami. At the end of my personal experiences, I would like to share a slideshow that I prepared about the orphanage where I work in India. We have 46 children, and my two best friends are headmaster and headmistress. And Swami actually sent two of his representatives to our school and actually gave us a formal name in Telugu, which I have the name there, and it means for the upliftment of humanity. And he made us a sister school to the boys' orphanage behind the ashram. All of this happened without any invitation or solicitation. It's all just kind of happened of its own. How many of you came to Swami through crisis, through some illness or some personal calamity or some suffering? Let me see your hands. Okay, and how many came to Swami, I would say, through a more graceful way? You were either born into a Sai family or you weren't called through crisis. You somehow saw his picture, heard about him, and you felt that he was the genuine article. Wow.
Okay. So the rest of you dummies that are like me, you will understand my talk a little better. Because I was called to Swami through crisis. Mine was not an easy path. Am I that boring already? It's interesting. Normally, when I speak to a group, it's the other way around. I'd say like 25-75, you know. But for whatever grace you've earned through previous births, you had a little easier path. You didn't have to walk across so many brambles and broken glass to get here today. I grew up in a family in North Carolina. My dad was a doctor at Duke University, and my mom was a school teacher of English. And I was raised in the Jewish faith. And my parents didn't really believe in God. We would go to the synagogue, and we would go through the motions and the rituals, but there was no real feeling of spirit. It was almost like a mechanical, robotic exercise. And I would sit in the synagogue, and I would sit in Hebrew class, and my rabbi was reading the newspaper. He was totally bored with us, and we were totally bored with him. And I would sit in the synagogue, and I'd feel like something was missing. I couldn't understand why everybody was coming to these things when they were so boring, and, you know, we were like, Gita Ram was saying she was waiting for Subramanyam Subramanyam until Swami would give out the Cadbury chocolates, right? I would wait till the service was over so we could go to the buffet and get all the cookies and the sweets. You know? We were counting the minutes. And I remember sleepwalking through my bar mitzvah. I was so removed from the whole experience that my rabbi even had to write my speech. I was just reading it kind of like a robot. There was really no connection to Judaism for me, and there wasn't really any discussion of God, and our family never prayed together. And when I was 18, I went off to a boarding school, and on my last year there, some Christian friends of mine invited me to a retreat, an off-site retreat, so I went with them, and they were trying to convert me because they felt I was a lost soul, but there was a heart connection there. And during that retreat at the lunch break, I went out and I sat in the woods by a stream there. And for the first time in my life, I felt the presence of a divine being. And it was actually Jesus. I actually felt him. I couldn't see him, but I could feel him walking through the woods and coming closer and closer to me until he was standing very close to me. And I had never felt that before. And so I felt there was something authentic about what they were doing in these retreats, but there was also the agenda underneath to try to convert and save as many souls and increase their numbers. And that didn't feel correct to me. It felt like there were mixed messages there. I didn't feel like I was particularly lost, so I didn't feel like I was particularly in the need of saving. I did require saving later on, but that was a number of years later. I'm gonna skip a few chapters and jump forward here. I was a star student when I was a kid. School was easy for me, and I had really enjoyed school. And I was always at the top of my class in straight A's and things like that. And did well in boarding school and graduated summa cum laude, etc. And then I was accepted to Cornell University. And as a freshman there, my dad was a doctor. I had always felt like I wanted to be a doctor. And I started enrolling in pre-med classes, and I saw things that I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I would be in chemistry lab, and I would see the students knock over and sabotage each other's experiments because they were so competitive they wanted to get ahead. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing, this level of competition and this dog-eat-dog. And I had gone from a small boarding school of about 450 students to a university of about 15,000. And I was completely adrift at sea. I was lost in this huge environment. And I would sit in these giant lecture halls, and you'd never meet your teacher. They'd be up there, you know, at the front, of, you know. And so it was a very alienating for me. And my mom, she had a lot of... She did not have an easy life growing up. And twice, once she tried to commit suicide And my dad came home from the hospital and he found her there. She'd taken a bunch of pills and they were able to get her stomach pumped out and save her. But she was always going up and down on the emotional roller coaster. And while I was at Cornell, she called me or I called her and she threatened to take her life again. And I went into a complete depression. I didn't know what to do with myself. As Phyllis Crystal talks about, the psychic cords, we were so connected that I also went into a depression and I stopped going to class. I couldn't concentrate. I would stare at the same page for hours. I couldn't comprehend. I couldn't absorb anything. And I didn't realize that I was depressed. So then, because I wasn't going to class, my grades started going down, down, down. And finally, they called me in for academic suspension. So here I was, the star student all my life, the one who was looked like I was going to excel, and all of a sudden, I'm falling from grace. They said, "We think you should take some time off and find out what you're made of and what you want to do." So after the second semester, I left Cornell, and I stayed in Ithaca, and I lived in a house there with a bunch of other students. And I started working in construction. Working with my hands was like therapy, and that was good for me. That helped me find out what I was made of, and I learned some good practical survival skills. And to this day, I'm a building contractor. The work that I do is putting in skylights. That's my specialty. And I did that for 4 years, and I met my ex-wife there, and we were together for 23 years. On my wedding day, as I stood up to take my vows, we were married very young, I heard Swami say inside, "You will not be able to fulfill this promise because this is not your true love." And it was a karmic marriage. I had to live with this partner for many, many years, and we have a 15 and a half year old daughter together. And we have reached some state of detente where I have a key to her house. She has a key to my apartment if we need to get something. We have peace now. But it was not an easy relationship. Every time Swami has called me in for interview, he has always asked me, "Where's your wife?" I say, "California, Swami." And he rolls his eyes like this and he looks away and everybody laughs at me like I'm the butt of some joke. So I flunked out of Cornell my first year. It was a huge disappointment to my parents and myself. But it was actually a blessing because I had really been living for other people's approval up to that time. I wasn't really living for myself. And after 4 years, I decided to go back and I enrolled in architecture school. I was accepted to Berkeley, and that's where I finished my BA. And as I was standing there in my cap and gown in the hot summer sun, I heard Swami say inside, "You're not going to sit behind a desk anymore." And I had put myself through college as a building contractor, working weekends and vacations doing remodeling. And Carter was president. Interest was 18-20%. All the architects were laying off their staffs in their office, so there wasn't really any architecture work. So I stayed continuing in construction to support myself and my wife. Around this time, I started to experience a spiritual yearning inside, and I couldn't explain it. It was like a divine discontent that was building inside of me. And my ex-wife was feeling it, and we started to grow in different directions. She was going more towards money and the world and materialistic things, and I was reading books like Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda. And I read that book, and that book had a profound effect on me. And I was thinking, here Yogananda had Yukteswar as his guru, and Yukteswar had Lahiri Mahasaya. And I was thinking, where's my guru? This is what I was thinking. I don't know where these thoughts were coming from. And for about 3 years, I was just praying silently, and I never told anybody this prayer. I said, "Lord, if there's a master on the planet with the powers of Christ or greater, I want to find that master, and I want that master to give me the same experience of God that these masters had given their disciples." And that was building. It was building in intensity. And on my 34th birthday, I went to the Vedanta Center in Alima because I was starting to go and fast and pray on my birthday. I would take my journal and I would walk in the woods and in the beaches and I would just take inventory on my birthday. I'd say, "Lord, how am I doing? And I just, am I being true to myself? And on that day, there was a couple passing through the monk's house where I was bunking upstairs. And we started talking about India. And he said, there's a teacher in India named Sai Baba. In fact, there's a book in the library with called The Holy Man and the Psychiatrist. I think you might be interested in that. So he went in there and he pulled that book out. And then they left and I never saw them again. Well, I took that book, The Holy Man and the Psychiatrist by Dr. Samwise, and I took it up to my room. And I opened that book. And the moment I started reading, I just started crying like a little baby. Because I knew instantly that I had found the master that I had been praying for. And I never went to sleep that night. That was in the late afternoon. I read that book backwards and forwards until the sun came up in the morning. And I probably ruined their copy because I was crying so much on every page. When I put it back on the shelf, it was probably all wilted. And that night I promised that I was going to somehow find my way to India to meet this master. After that, I looked in the phone book and I found the San Francisco Sai Baba Center. And I started going to bhajans. And I was hearing these bhajans, and I had been raised in the synagogue, so I was used to hearing Hebrew and all this foreign language that I couldn't understand. So this were kind of weird songs, but I could accept them. You know, they weren't that different. And then that Christmas, I joined a group and came to India to see Swami for the first time. Now, this probably brings me to the most important part of my journey. I was experiencing frustration in my work. My ex-wife was telling me, you need to make more money. You're just a, you know, a laborer. You're just a carpenter. You need to get a white-collar job. You know, she was pushing. And there was a lot of spiritual sandpaper in our relationship. So I started taking some real estate seminars. And most of the people at these things were kind of into the whole get rich quick, you know, buy property and fix it up, foreclosures and things like that. Well, I ended up buying a house. This was in a lower income section of East Bay. There was a black family there. And I owned that house for 2 years. I never had the key to the front door to that house. Swami guided me to this family to basically kind of do social work and take care of them. I ended up working on the house, bringing it up to code. The woman eventually died of cancer, and a lot of times they didn't have enough food to eat. I would go over and bring food and take them shopping for groceries. There was a lot of pathology in that family, and I basically was a social worker without any formal training. And I was able to sell the house back to that family at a reduced monthly payment, but then they lost it to foreclosure again. They missed the payment, and they ended up losing it. Everything I did to try to help this family helped for a little while, and then it went south. And I started to realize that sometimes somebody's karma is so strong that the undertow is so powerful that they have to go through what they have to go through. So after this first house, I found out about another house. And this turned out to be my Waterloo. And this was the crucifixion that actually brought me to Swami. Because in the second house, I was able to pick it up for about 50% of what it was worth, because it was also in foreclosure. A couple approached me from across the street, and they asked if they could rent the house. And it was a black neighborhood, and I had been raised in the South, and I was raised to be colorblind. So I'll let you live there. It turned out this man was one of the biggest drug dealers in West Oakland, and I didn't know it. And they wanted to make some improvements on the house in return for reduced rent. Well, they never ended up paying me any money for rent. And when I saw what they were doing, they were actually destroying the house. So I said to him, you have to stop, and you'll have to leave. And he was very angry. And so they went and they changed the locks and barricaded themselves in my rental house, and I couldn't even get in. And I had to go to court, and I had to go to the sheriff to get them evicted. They stood up in court on the first time, and they were drunk as skunks, and they lied to the judge and said that they'd given me all this cash, which they hadn't. And fortunately for my attorney, the judge dismissed the case, but they wouldn't accept no for an answer, so they went to court again and sued me. finally I was successful and I was able to evict them and I was able to get the house back. Now imagine I've got this house. I have a picture of this house here. But so I was kind of, this was how I was pulled into the Psi fold through this experience with the house. Imagine that I'm paying the mortgage on a house. I have no income. I've got the drug dealer in there. He won't get out. Finally, after many, many months, I was able to evict him. During this time, I was on the verge of facing bankruptcy because I had spent so much money to fix it up and I was paying the mortgage. I was taking no income and my construction business was declining at that time. My marriage was also very difficult. And this is what brought me to my knees. One day I went out behind my house where I was living, not this house, but where I was living, and I walked through the woods and I came into a pasture there. And there was a little lake. There was a Boy Scout camp. And I was just crying and crying and crying. And my mantra was, Lord, I surrender to you. I'm just walking. Lord, I surrender to you. Lord, I surrender to you. And I'm just crying these big crocodile tears. And there's no sun. It's overcast and foggy. And as I'm crying and I'm just saying, Lord, I've totally messed up my life. I don't know where to turn. I surrender everything to you. I surrender to you. And I didn't know I was walking. I was just walking blindly out into this pasture. And I really felt lost. I was felt completely lost. I didn't know where to turn. And it was the first time in my life when I had actually had thoughts of suicide. It might be easier way out than what I was going through with this drug dealer. At that moment, about 100 yards away over this little lake, I see a double rainbow appear. And it wasn't way up in the sky. It was maybe about, 30 feet off above the ground, and it's touching the ground. And this double rainbow starts moving towards me. And I can see the grass and the ground changing colors as the rainbow's coming closer and closer and closer. And I was telling Krishna and Chandrika this last night, that rainbow came and it came right above me and stopped. And as that double rainbow stopped on top of me, I felt this electricity, this Shakti just pour down through my crown chakra. And at that moment, I felt my prayer had been answered by God. And this is not the rainbow. This is just a picture I took off the net of a double rainbow. But you have to imagine there was no sun. You would have to have sun to make a rainbow. It was foggy and it was drizzling. And after this experience of the electricity, and I felt this calm come over me, then I hear this voice inside say, and now a change is going to come. I did not know what that meant. But a few days later, I received a letter in the mail from a real estate agent who I'd never met, who said, I have a buyer for your house. And at that time, after he was evicted, I had a for rent sign up there. I went over and met him in Oakland. It turned out that he was a black man. He was a devotee of Muktananda when Muktananda was alive, and he used to take his wife to their ashram there for Shaktipat when Muktananda was alive. So within 15 minutes, I signed the papers on the hood of his car because I feel, I'm not waiting for the helicopter. God sent the rowboat. I'm getting in, And the first buyer that he brought fell through. They couldn't get credit. And I thought, oh my God, I'm cursed. I'm cursed with this house, this albatross around my neck. The second buyer he brought offered me more money for the house than I was asking. On the day that I flew to see Swami for the first time in 1988, 21 years ago, that escrow closed and I was able to pay off all my debts. And then I had some cushion in the bank to come home to. So what I was learning was eternal vigilance. I was not very discriminating. I trusted people that didn't deserve to be trusted. And this is one of the things that I want to share with you today is my journey in terms of waking up and becoming more discriminating. Now, let me jump back here. When I got to the ashram, on the way, I cried a lot because I felt like I was coming home. But when I got there, it was in the afternoon bhajans. I looked at Swami and I didn't really feel anything. And I felt a little disappointed. I said, oh my God, I came all this way and, you know, where's all the bells and whistles and the fireworks? And for the first week or so, when I would sit in darshan, Swami would come out, and I would be with the men. As soon as he got to me, he'd make a big circle around me like I was radioactive, like I had just been dipped in a sewer or something. He wasn't going to come near me. And to the point where it was so predictable that the guys in my group were starting to wonder whether they wanted to sit with me anymore. On December 20th, our group got called for one of two interviews that year. And Swami gave me a pretty good chewing out in that interview. I was not prepared for this. He was scolding me. He's telling me, you mad, mad monkey mind. You're too impatient. You're always, mind is jumping around. And then he said to me, he said, you don't appreciate your parents enough, especially your mother, because you're a man and you don't realize the sacrifice that a woman goes through to carry a child and deliver a child. And the irony of this was that I had just written a long letter to my mom before getting on the plane, thanking her for carrying me for 9 months, where I had gone into great appreciation. So maybe he was using me as a lightning rod to teach somebody else a lesson, or maybe I wasn't appreciating her as much as I should have. I don't know. Anyway, I was so embarrassed by the scolding. I was looking around for the trap door, and I didn't want to come out of my roundhouse room for about 3 days because I didn't want to show my face after this chewing out. And the brothers and sisters were coming up to me saying, oh, you're so lucky the avatar talked to you. You should be very grateful. And I wasn't feeling very grateful. So 8 days later, Swami called us in for a second interview. And after he made vibhuti for the ladies, and I was sitting as far away from him as I possibly could. You know, I'd had a taste of the avatar. And it wasn't what I expected. Anyway, after he made the vibhuti for the ladies, he waved his hand like this, and he cupped his hands together, and there was a big pile of white halva, and it was still steaming from the cosmic oven where he brought it. And he passed that around, and I ate that cream of wheat, and it was the most delicious thing that I have ever tasted on this earth. I never tasted anything like it. And after I ate this, I felt this column of light coming up from the center of the earth all up my spine and then extending up through the ceiling up into the heavens. And it was so strong that I could lean back against it and it would support me. And as this was happening, I felt this fountain of love just pouring up inside of me like a cup overflowing. Ananda is the only thing that I've heard people describe, this complete bliss. And at the same time this was happening, my mind totally stopped. I had absolutely no thoughts, and I'd never experienced thoughtless awareness before. And Swami was sitting over in his chair, and he kind of gave me the eye, you know. He'd look over at me like that. He was fine-tuning the dials on this little engine. And I didn't realize it, but a Sai sister on the lady side was having the same experience as me. As I'm sitting here, I'm in total peace, total bliss, and this love, this fountain is just overflowing inside of me. And then I hear him say telepathically inside, this is the peace that passeth all understanding that you have read about in the Bible. And then I hear him say, your purpose has been fulfilled. You can die now. There's nothing for you to do. There's nothing for you to read. There's no place for you to go. And I'm sitting in this complete bliss. And I'm looking over at Swami, and I realize that I am not this body. I am the spirit inside this thing. And I'm looking out through these eyes and I'm watching everything like I'm at a movie show. And I'm immovable. I am literally rooted to the earth. I cannot move. I'm completely merged with this column of light that's coming up through my spine up into the heavens. Gradually, 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 the interview's coming to an end. And then I'm coming back into normal body awareness, into dualistic consciousness. And I was like one of the last people to leave the room. And I said to Swami, thank you, Swami, for having us in, you know, like you would thank the usher at a movie theater. I was so clueless. This was my first trip. I had no idea really who Swami was. But on that day, he had shown me his divinity, and he had also given me a taste of my own divinity. I was in this heightened state of bliss. I didn't want to be around anybody. So I took my things off the veranda and I hiked up to the old administration building up where the old museum used to be, up at the top of the, you know, past the meditation tree. And I found a big boulder out there to climb up on so nobody would come near me. And I wrote in my journal, I said, "Swami, even if you never look at me, I still feel your divine love." Because remember, he had been ignoring me, you know, all week long, to the point where I was, you know, I was in the doghouse with my Sai brothers there, and they were avoiding me. I sit on the rock, and I feel my hands going into these mudras that I have never learned. I'm in this heightened state, and I'm still in this bliss. And I closed my eyes, and I just sat in meditation. And I don't know how long I was in this state, but a little breeze came up, and it blew my shirt open. And there, when I opened my eyes, were 5 packets of vibhuti in a rainbow pattern, inner view vibhuti, at my feet on the rock. And I was way up on this 8-foot boulder. Nobody could have gotten up there. And I thought, well, maybe I'd reached into my darshan bag and grabbed some inner view vibhuti and somehow smushed it around here while I was in meditation, you know. And I opened up my bag and I counted my packets, and it seemed like I still had the same amount. And it wasn't till 12 or 15 years later that a Sai sister in the recording studio, she said, "Lad, you goose, Swami was showing you that he made the rainbow that day. So he arranged those little packets in a perfect rainbow pattern for you." I was so thick I didn't get it until many, many years later. Well, I just started crying like a little baby because I had never had any materialization before. And after that day, Swami stopped avoiding me in the darshan lines. That was my first visit to Swami. A few days later, I was in the sheds. How many people here know Al and Al Levy from New York City? You know, Al. He was teaching a meditation class in one of the sheds. And during that meditation class, I suddenly felt tremendous grief. It was bringing up a big catharsis. And I knew I was going to have to go home to this marriage that was very difficult. And I was just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And that morning, I had opened Al Drucker's Gita. And I had just opened it at random. And there was a passage in there where Krishna says, "When my devotee completely calls out and surrendered to me, my grace descends upon that devotee like a lightning flash." And I didn't think much of it, but it touched me in my heart. And as I'm sitting there crying and crying, nobody's coming to my aid. Al doesn't get up. His wife doesn't get up to come over to me and say, "Are you okay?" I feel like I'm all alone. And I can't control this. This sobbing is uncontrollable. And I've never experienced this before. And I'm thinking, "Lord, I surrender to you." I just keep repeating that same mantra inside. And at this moment, when I feel like I'm breaking inside, I feel this Swami's robe brushing up against the back of my, I'm sitting cross-legged like a yogi, and I feel him brushing up against behind me like this. And then I feel his leg pressing into me, but there's nobody there. This is a Swami in his energy body. And then he's pressing, his leg is pressing my leg, and all of a sudden, he's merged inside of me. And the experience that I had in the interview room was of this calm peace. But what happened now was, it was like a volcano inside of me. It was literally like a geyser, like a volcano of kundalinis coming up through me. And all of a sudden, my body turns to stone. I'm paralyzed, almost like petrified stone, and I cannot move. And this energy is coming up through me, and then out through my third eye, my awareness goes out through my third eye, and with my eyes closed, I can see the astral side. I can see all these beautiful colors and things, and then I can actually feel the chakras spinning on the body. And the chakras, these energy wheels, they're a few inches off the surface. I haven't seen them since or felt them since, but I can actually feel the individual chakras spinning. And in my ears, I'm hearing the Om, but it's like the roar of a thousand rivers. It's this incredible, powerful, like you're sitting right next to Niagara Falls and you can't even hear yourself think. all my energy is pulled up on a puppet string, like a marionette, and all my consciousness is going out through my third eye, and I'm seeing all this beautiful things on the other side. I don't know how long that lasted, but I understand now the perfection of why nobody came up to touch me, because I was in this, I was gone. I was not on this earth. Gradually, I started to come back into my body, but out of my hands were coming columns of light. The only thing I could describe it is like Star Trek. You know when, like in the Star Wars where they have the light coming out of the saber? Out of my hands was coming these columns of energy, almost like a magnetic field. And there was a person next to me, and I said, "Can you feel this?" And they could feel it very strong. And I had them walk like 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, until the range dissipated. It was about 10, 12 feet. Gradually, I came back into, quote, normal body consciousness, and all that dissolved. After that day, nothing was quite the same. I would still go about my duties and everything, but when I would look at people, it's like I could see God inside of them. I could see their divinity more clearly. And I don't pretend to be realized or liberated or anything like that. Believe me, I am stand before you as a work in progress. So I don't want to give the wrong impression here. But on that day, Swami opened the door to the cage, and this bird got to fly for a few moments and feel true freedom. And then he came and put me back in my cage. And that was 21 years ago. Now, when I came home, I was worse than a born-again Christian that had to convert everybody, because I had just had these amazing experiences, and I wanted everybody to know about them, and I wanted them to have the same experience. This is my naivete. So I would lie in my bed at night. I was feeling very lonely for Swami, and I'm coming home to this unfulfilling marriage and a lot of problems. And I'm saying, "Swami, do you still remember me? Am I just like a devotee out there in thousands and millions or whatever? Is it really true that you're omnipresent?" This is my monkey mind doubting. So I'm lying there. I came back in January. I had no customer calls for my roofing and skylight business. I only had two calls that January. In the first one, I don't know if this is going to come on or not. The first one was on a street. Let's see if it comes. Okay. It was on Sai Street. So I'm thinking, this is just coincidental, right? This is my monkey mind. No customer calls. The first estimate I get to go out and do a roof estimate is on Sai Street in San Anselmo. And I'm thinking, is this just dumb luck? I have to explain to you, the dumber we are, the bigger the miracle is required to get through. Do you understand what I'm saying? I am capable of being very dense. So Swami had to make double rainbows. He had to all these bells and whistles because I was not paying attention. So a few weeks goes by, and I get a second call to do an estimate on Why Worry Court in Nevada. Now, I had a picture of the sign here, and I scanned it at FedEx, but when I tried to put it into the PowerPoint, it was all grainy, so I had to go to Google to find Why Worry Court, because for some reason the CD wouldn't transfer the picture without so much granularity. So now I'm starting to think, maybe this avatar is real. Forget the fact that he completely rewired me and plugged me into 220, way beyond 220, 1,008 volts, and sent me home. So then I began to surrender a little bit into trust. Okay, that comes a little bit later. How much time do I have? 1 hour. How many people here have experienced similar, weather phenomena or things like that? Say a little bit about.
And at intermission, some of my friends went home because it was getting bad weather. So my husband and I stayed. And I'd been to mystery school before and dance therapy and stuff. So anyway, they invited us, the audience, to dance with them. It was a family. And David Gueshe and his family. And they had dancers, and he played music. And then after intermission, they plugged in. They did acoustic beforehand and did like a harvest grain dance or whatever. But then after intermission, they plugged in, and it starts raining. I say, Swami, keep these guys safe because they're holding the microphone, holding the electric guitar and stuff. And finally, somebody from Botanic Garden says, we're going to cut the program short. They can do one more song. So he says, we're going to do two more songs. And he talked about one, the Jewish man who had to ask Jesus a question. And he was walking through the night. So then they did a song and dance for that. And then he did another traditional Zimbabwe song dedicated to peace and goodwill. And for troubles to be over in Zimbabwe. And I got up, and I don't know, a dozen, two dozen people from the audience got up. And we're just dancing. I'm dancing my heart out. I'm more about this kind of palm tree looking thing, kind of trying to not be the center of attention, or just let go of ego and dance. But I was dancing my heart out. And then towards the end of the song, meanwhile, they're pulling all the side parts of the tarps so that the rain's not coming in sideways on people. But at the end of the dance, there's this double rainbow. And it goes straight down into the bell tower of the Carillon, which is like the iconic symbol for the garden of, they have Monday Carillon concerts there in the summer. So it's the icon for music, and it was across the water. And I was asking Swami, bless the people in Zimbabwe, across the Atlantic, across the water. So it really felt like the family's dance. It was an effort for them to come because of the political situation. But I really felt like Swami, whatever name and form this man was inviting, was really hearing our prayer.
Sairam, so, yeah, that's very Sairam. Cool. Anybody else get weird weather phenomena?
Actually, I have two. One was about a couple years ago. Lately, I'm doing contract jobs. And the contract job was coming up, and it happened to be...
Hey, Sairam. You know, the amazing thing to me is that each of us has our own heart-to-heart relationship with Swami. And each is unique. When I came back, my life actually started to become more difficult. A lot of the issues that I had swept under the rug that I did not want to face, now Swami was bringing up for me to have to work on. And I would say after coming to Swami, it was my 34th birthday was really my first birthday. It was more like a slow sunrise in my life. Those two experiences in the ashram were like a supernova going off, but then I had to digest that and integrate that and go back to chopping wood and carrying water when I came home. I'm going to jump ahead about 20 years and share something with you now that we're on the subject of Vibhuti. 2 years ago on 9/11, I fell off a ladder. And that morning, I woke up and I ended up landing on the concrete, and I ended up fracturing my pelvis here and here, and ended up having to have a 3.5-inch titanium pin put in Humpty Dumpty here to hold me back together again. A few days before, I had had a clairvoyant dream where I saw myself lying in the hospital, and I'd seen the whiteboard that the nurse had written, fallen from ladder, fractured pelvis. I didn't put the two puzzle pieces together. That morning when I woke up, I could not get into my body. I felt like I was walking about 6 inches off the ground. I don't remember the paramedics coming. I don't remember going into the MRI and the CAT scanner. I just remember waking up in the hospital room and seeing what the nurse had written and realizing kind of what had happened. And I had a mild concussion. When you hit your spine, the concussion goes up and it affects the... So while I was in the hospital, sometimes I would lie there and I would feel like a cool breeze blowing through me, this healing energy. And I'd just silently say, "Swami, what is that?" He said, "That's all the people praying for you, all the Sai family, people praying for you." I had never experienced that before, but I could lie there and I could literally feel this refreshing, healing energy, just very gentle, very loving, just permeating through me. On the last day I was at the hospital after the surgery, before they transferred me to the old folks' home, the nurse comes in and she says, and most of the nurses there were Filipina, by the way. This was a pale face, a white nurse who lived there in Grass Valley. And it turned out that she knew a couple of friends of mine. She said, "I don't understand all these people that are coming to visit you. They seem really different. They're very special. There's a lot of light in here." And I didn't know what to tell her. I said, "Well, you know, they're all friends. They're all friends from my church." And she says, "What church do you belong to?" I said, "It's a Unity church." And she says, "Oh, really? Is it such and such Unity?" I said, "Not really. It's more like a unity of all faiths." And then I heard Swami say, "Okay, you can tell her. As we follow the teachings of a master who teaches the unity of all faiths. His name is Sai Baba." And she says, "Oh, I have two friends that are Sai Baba devotees." And at that moment, I hear Swami, like a very forceful command inside, say like this, "They are to have my vibhuti." Just like the Ten Commandments, you know, where you hear this voice out of the heavens. So I reach over to this little container that I have, and there's nothing in there. I've been, you know, licking to get the last little grains and dust out of this thing, and there's nothing in this little container, little plastic container. And I'm thinking, "Swami, you want me to give them what?" So I tore off a little piece of paper. I figured if there's dust in there, they're going to get fumes. There's nothing in the engine of this little container. So I tore off the piece of paper, I creased it, and I reached over, took the top of the thing, and I reached over to pour it. And as I'm reaching over to pour it, I see the container fill up to about a quarter inch before my very eyes of this sweet, sweet, fresh vibhuti. I had had vibhuti in there from Mahaligappa's from Mysore, which I brought to share today. And I didn't say anything to her because I don't think she knew about materialization, but I had plenty. I gave her plenty and folded it all up. That was the first time that Swami had materialized for me, you know, in a situation like that. And as I was pouring the vibhuti, I heard him say inside, "You will never live in scarcity consciousness again." And from there, they transferred me to the old folks' home, you know, where I had to get out of, learn to walk again, get out of the wheelchair, and learn to use crutches and all this. Now I'm going to jump around a lot today because I didn't come with any prepared remarks. I made some notes in the airplane, but I just usually just tune in and ask Swami, what is it that people need to hear today? So I'm also getting guidance that I need to share with you this next little piece here. But I want to sing a bhajan before we go to the next chapter.